when Trump was asked if it is his job to uphold the Constitution, he said, "I don't know." Claudia de la Cruz says, "Trump and his cabinet full of billionaires are waging an all-out war on our communities, from slashing thousands of jobs to massively defunding critical programs that many working-class people rely on to survive. At this critical moment," she says, "we can't simply lay down and allow his administration to roll back all the rights that our people's movements have won. Now is the time to organize our communities and stand up to fight back," unquote. In these dark times, we cannot be bystanders. We must resist and imagine and create a new world where peace, equality, dignity, and justice are the norm. Our guest today is Claudia de la Cruz. She's an educator and community organizer. For nearly 30 years, she's worked on building people power locally, nationally, and internationally. In 2024, she ran for President of the United States, representing the Party of Socialism and Liberation. She's the Executive Director of IFCO.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And through this new law, Mr. President, every citizen will be able, in his productive years when he's earning, to insure himself against the ravages of illness in his old age. This insurance will help pay for care in hospitals, in skilled nursing homes, or in the home.
60 years after President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid into law, Republicans are cutting $1 trillion from Medicaid over the next decade. 17 million Americans could lose their health insurance overall. One estimate projects 51,000 people will die each year as a result of the cuts. We'll speak to Ai-Jen Poo. She just organized a 60-hour Medicaid vigil. This month also marks 35 years since the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll speak to the head of the American Association of People with Disabilities about the devastating effects of cuts to Medicaid, then to Gaza, as seven more Palestinians starved to death in the last day.
We're being slaughtered and are dying. We are calling on the entire world to just provide beds. We are left on the floor. Flies have eaten us, and the blood. The floor is full of blood. There's no care, no resources to offer us.
We'll speak to Arwa Damon, the former CNN journalist who founded Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Plus, we go to the occupied West Bank, where an Israeli settler fatally shot Oda Hadlin, a prominent Palestinian activist who worked on the Oscar-winning film No Other Land.
When they arrived here, I was the one who's in front of him. I just filmed him, trying to tell him, please don't shoot anyone. There's too many people, there's children. Stop. And suddenly he started shooting a lot of belts everywhere.
The Israeli settler who shot Odeh is under international sanction, but the Trump administration lifted the U.S. sanctions against him. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hospitals in Gaza are reporting seven new deaths due to famine and malnutrition as Israel continues its starvation campaign against the Palestinian territory. Gaza's hunger-related death toll is now at 154, with at least 89 children among the dead. Palestinian officials say Israel allowed just 109 aid trucks to cross into the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, with most of them looted amidst escalating security chaos. The UN says 500 500 to 600 truckloads of aid are needed each day to meet the basic needs of Gaza's more than 2 million residents. On Tuesday, displaced Palestinian mother Jahan Al-Quran was forced to collect scattered pasta from the dirt for her seven children to eat after she returned from a soup kitchen in Nusayrat Tuesday empty-handed.
We're in a great famine. I'm in a famine now. I'm in a famine because the meal they give isn't sufficient for me at all. I only have this meal for an entire day until the following day when I come back to look for soup kitchen to get food for my children. I only have this meal. Look at me. I have malnutrition from the lack of food. I feel dizzy when I walk.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces are continuing deadly attacks on Palestinians with at least 21 people killed since dawn, 13 of them while seeking aid. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced Tuesday the UK will recognize a Palestinian state in September unless Israel agrees to a ceasefire.
So today, as part of this process towards peace, I can confirm the UK will recognize the state of Palestine by the United Nations General Assembly in September, unless the Israeli government takes substantive steps to end the appalling situation in Gaza, agree to a ceasefire, and commit to a long-term sustainable peace, reviving the prospect of a two-state solution.
Some British activists and politicians criticized Starmer's announcement as performative and disingenuous. A member of the Scottish Parliament, Ross Greer, wrote on social media, quote, Starmer wouldn't threaten to withdraw UK recognition of Israel, but he's made recognition of Palestinian statehood conditional on the actions of their genocidal oppressor, unquote. Separately, Malta announced Tuesday it'll also recognize a Palestinian state in September. 147 of the UN 193 member states currently recognize the state of Palestine. Meanwhile, the Netherlands has banned two key figures in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition, the far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. The European Union also proposed suspending Israel from a tech investment program in response to the starvation of Gaza. A new report finds Canada continued to arm Israel despite pledging to halt arms shipments back in January of last year. Researchers from World Beyond War, the Palestinian Youth Movement, Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, and Independent Jewish Voices uncovered Israeli import data and publicly available shipping records showing the Canadian government had sent weapons parts and ammunition to Israel. Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders plans to force a vote to block U.S. arms sales to Gaza. In a statement, Senator Sanders said, quote, U.S. taxpayers have spent tens of billions of dollars in support of the racist, extremist Netanyahu government. Enough is enough. We cannot continue to spend taxpayer money on a government which has killed some 60,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 143,000, most of whom are women, children, and the elderly, Sanders said. 44 members of the Senate's Democratic caucus have signed on to a letter urging President Trump to stop funding the shadowy U.S. and Israeli-backed so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which was created to take over aid deliveries in Gaza, replacing the United Nations. Meanwhile, far-right Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has become the first Republican Congress member to call Israel's actions in Gaza a genocide. In more news from Capitol Hill, over two dozen rabbis were arrested Tuesday as they occupied the office of Republican Majority Leader John Thune while nonviolently protesting the Israeli government's blockade of Gaza. The protesters represent 750 rabbis and Jewish clergy and over 23,000 Jews who signed a statement calling for immediate food aid to Gaza. They come from all denominations of the Jewish faith. Activist Deborah Zavos spoke as she was led away from Tuesday's protest in handcuffs.
Stop this forced starvation. We're here as Jews because our religion demands that we be here and stand up.
Zavos was wearing a Jewish prayer shawl. An 8.8 magnitude earthquake struck Russia's Far East early Wednesday, sending tsunami waves to Japan, Hawaii, and the west coast of the United States. Initially, millions of people were in the path of the tsunami and were told to take steps to move away from the shore and seek higher ground. But no major damage has been reported so far. The U.S. Senate has confirmed Emil Bovee to a lifetime appointment as a federal judge on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Just two Republicans sided with Democrats in Tuesday night's 50-49 vote, despite complaints about Bovee's conduct as a senior Justice Department official. Two whistleblowers report he told subordinates to ignore court orders blocking Trump's deportation orders. Another whistleblower claimed Bovee lied to senators about his role in dismissing charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. Bovee was formerly Trump's lawyer, defending him in three trials. New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker spoke ahead of his confirmation.
This is a sad day for our democracy. This is a sad day for the judiciary, and a sad day for the United States Senate, whose constitutional obligation is to advise and consent, to look at all of the evidence, especially when you have whistleblowers standing up with courage and wanting to speak the truth.
The Trump administration's removed two top officials from the Justice Department's antitrust division, which promotes competition and sues to prevent monopolies. Bill Rinner and Roger Alford were fired for insubordination amidst disputes over recent corporate mega mergers, including T-Mobile's purchase of U.S. Cellular and Hewlett-Packard Enterprise's $14 billion acquisition of Juniper Networks. CBS News reports the HP merger was approved only after Attorney General Pam Bondi's chief of staff overruled the head of the antitrust division, Gail Slater. Democrats are demanding an investigation into the firings. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar wrote, quote, "The antitrust division has long worked to enforce the law to fight monopoly power, but these attorneys may have been fired for doing just that," Klobuchar said. The Trump administration's formally proposed ending the Obama-era scientific determination that greenhouse gas emissions endanger public health. The finding is the basis of a 2009 rule that allowed the Environmental Protection Agency to set limits on greenhouse gas pollution from cars, power plants, and other sources. On Tuesday, EPA Chief Lee Zeldin used an Indianapolis truck dealership as a backdrop as he proposed ending the endangerment finding, calling it the largest deregulatory action in the history of the United States. The Sierra Club condemned Zeldin's move, writing, quote, "As if any doubt remain, the Trump administration has formalized climate denial as the official policy of the United States government," unquote. In more climate news, the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration is warning workers could face potentially lethal conditions as temperatures soar into the triple digits across much of the eastern seaboard and Great Plains regions. Tens of millions of people in 31 states were advised to stay inside Tuesday amidst extreme heat warnings. Meanwhile, the government of Greece has asked the European Union to help battle wildfires as the eastern Mediterranean region swelters under extreme heat. Turkey's environment ministry recently reported a reading of 50.5 degrees Celsius, or 123 degrees Fahrenheit, an all-time high temperature record for Turkey. Jeffrey Epstein's co-conspirator and convicted sex trafficker, Ghislaine Maxwell, has offered to testify before Congress if she's granted immunity. The House Oversight Committee subpoenaed Maxwell to testify next month. On Tuesday, President Trump once again referred to Epstein stealing his workers from his Mar-a-Lago club, admitting one of them was Virginia Giuffre, one of Epstein's abuse survivors who met him when she was a teenager. Giuffre reportedly died by suicide in Australia in April.
I think she worked at the spa. I think so. I think that was one of the people. He stole her. And by the way, she had no complaints about us, as you know, none whatsoever.
Here in New York, police have revealed new details about Monday's mass shooting in Midtown Manhattan. Investigators say 27-year-old gunman Shane Devon Tamura used an M4 assault-style rifle in the attack, which killed a police officer, a security guard, a real estate associate, and a senior executive at the investment firm Blackstone. However, the shooter appeared to be targeting the NFL's corporate headquarters. In a 3-page handwritten suicide note, Tamura wrote playing football had left him with the neurodegenerative disease CTE, which is linked to head trauma. His note read in part, quote, "Please study brain for CTE. I'm sorry. The league knowingly concealed the dangers to our brains to maximize profits. They failed us," he wrote in a suicide note. And Virginia Commonwealth University has agreed to grant a diploma to Palestinian-American student Serene Haddad after withholding it until now. Haddad earned a 4-year degree in psychology at VCU in just 3 years, earning the highest honors along the way. She was denied her diploma at her graduation this year after campus officials cited her participation in a peaceful memorial commemorating violent police arrests at a student encampment for Palestine in 2024. Serene is the daughter of Dr. Tarek Haddad, a cardiologist who grew up in Gaza. They have lost more than 200 members of their extended family in Israel's nearly 2-year-long U.S.-backed assault. Serene Haddad spoke to Democracy Now! Tuesday just after learning she would receive her diploma following a months-long appeal to the VCU Student Conduct Board.
One thing I want to make absolutely clear is that this was not VCU choosing to do the right thing or them waking up and realizing that they made an error. This was the result of pressure on a case that they could not defend. It was the result of truth prevailing, and they were left with no choice because the truth was always on our side. I cannot separate this small victory from the reality that at this very same moment, millions of Palestinians are being starved in Gaza intentionally, systematically, and with the support of the very systems that tried to silence me. And the fact that I had to fight for my own diploma, something that I rightfully earned, is a testament to the exact same systems that are upholding and enabling genocide.
To see our joint interview with Serene Haddad and her father, Dr. Tarek Haddad, visit our website at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 60 years ago today, Medicare and Medicaid were signed into law. On July 30th, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Social Security Amendments of 1965 at the Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri. LBJ wanted to honor former President Harry Truman, who tried but failed to pass low-cost medical care for the elderly. At the signing ceremony, former President Truman and his wife, Bess Truman, were given the first two Medicare cards in the country. This is President Johnson.
There are more than 18 million Americans over the age of 65. Most of them have low income. Most of them are threatened by illness and medical expenses that they cannot afford. And through this new law, Mr. President, every citizen will be able, in his productive years when he's earning, to insure himself against the ravages of illness in his old age. This insurance will help pay for care in hospitals, in skilled nursing homes, or in the home. And under a separate plan, it will help meet the fees of the doctors.
For 60 years, Medicare and Medicaid have been the bedrock of health care in the United States. Well, on July 4th, President Trump signed his controversial budget reconciliation bill into law. In order to extend tax cuts for the rich, the budget slashes nearly $1 trillion from Medicaid over the next decade. 17 million Americans could lose their health insurance overall. One estimate projects 51,000 people will die each year as a result of the cuts. Last week, organizers held a 60 hours for 60 years of Medicaid vigil as part of a broader campaign to fight back against these cuts. For more, we're joined by one of the vigil's organizers, Ai-Jen Poo, executive director and co-founder of Caring Across Generations, as well as president and co-founder of the Domestic Workers Alliance. She's joining us from the airport in Chicago. Ai-Jen, thanks so much for joining us before you get on this plane. Can you talk on this day, the 60th anniversary of signing Medicare and Medicaid into law, the dangers to these bedrock programs in the United States?
Well, Amy, for 60 years, Americans and our families have relied on Medicaid as a safety net to catch us when and if we fall. It's been a promise that we have made to each other and future generations that we will be supported to take care of ourselves and our loved ones. And that promise has been broken by this cut. And what we wanted to do in our 60-hour vigil was put a human face on every single one of those $1 trillion that's going to be cut from Medicaid. I think people don't realize the extent to which Medicaid is not just a healthcare program that including reproductive health and maternal health. 40% of all babies born in the United States are covered by Medicaid, but it is also a long-term care program providing direct care for older adults and people with disabilities. And that work, that program is more important than ever as we have a growing aging population in our country. When LBJ signed Medicaid and Medicare into law, he had no idea that people would be living longer, baby boomers aging into retirement at a rate of 10,000 people per day, chronic illnesses like Alzheimer's and dementia proliferating. We are a country that needs more care than ever before, and the unmet need out there is tremendous. These cuts are going to be devastating. It is a matter of life and death. Literally, Medicaid has been a lifeline, and without it, people will die.
I wanted to go to Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, speaking at the protest you organized, 60 Hours for 60 Years of Medicaid.
About $1 trillion was cut from Medicaid. That's $1 trillion that was going to help people with disabilities, going to help people in nursing homes, going to help people struggling with substance use challenges, going to help Americans in need, because that was the compact that we made. And so when you take $1 trillion out of that important healthcare support network to give a tax cut to billionaires, people need to know about what happened.
So that's Senator Chris Van Hollen. Ai-Jen Poo, can you talk about elder care more in detail? The aging population in this country, largely immigrant workforce that cares for them, the combined impacts of the Medicaid cuts and the crackdown on immigration.
Yes. So every day, the baby boom generation ages into retirement at a rate of 10,000 people. And because of advances in technology, we are living longer than ever before, an average of 20 to 30 years longer than when Medicaid and Medicare were first signed into law. So we've essentially added an entire generation onto our lifespan without adapting our systems or our policies to support it. And the system in place is Medicaid. Literally, Medicaid is the largest payer of long-term care in our country. 69% of all direct care worker wages, the wages of the workers who we count on to take care of our aging parents and our disabled loved ones, comes from Medicaid. There are already 700,000 people who are on waiting lists for Medicaid home and community-based services. That means the care and assistance that older people and disabled people need in order to stay in their homes connected to their communities. With these cuts, all of that infrastructure, all of that is at stake. Now, when it comes to immigrants, immigrants are a third of our home care workforce. Literally 32% of our home care workforce is immigrant. And there is no way that we will meet this country's need for care without a strong immigrant workforce. And it is an all hands on deck situation. When the number of people over the age of 85 is going to double by the year 2040, we need immigrants, we need non-immigrants, we need friends, family, neighbors, everyone to help care for the people we love. And we should be embracing the fact that there are so many immigrants who want to do this work, who see it as a calling, not terrorizing them and their families and deporting, separating families, creating a hostile environment where people are afraid to get on public transportation to see their clients. People are afraid to go to work. And these are people who have status. And a whole bunch of people are about to lose their temporary protected status. So in places like Florida, where a huge percentage of the workforce are immigrants who are here working legally on their protected status, their temporary status, this administration is revoking that status, and we're about to lose a huge amount of the workforce and infrastructure we rely on for dignity and quality of life for older people and people with disabilities.
So you have $1 trillion being cut from these essential programs to pay for trillions of dollars in tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. This weekend, you held a vigil. Do you see this as a done deal? And on this landmark anniversary of Medicaid and Medicare, 60 years ago it was signed, can you talk about the movement that achieved Medicaid and what you see needs to happen now?
The movement that achieved Medicaid is a movement of families, of older people, of people with disabilities, and family caregivers, of workers, working class people who organized together to say, we deserve in this country, the wealthiest country in the world, to have a safety net of care. And that is exactly the coalition that is coming together now, that has been coming together since COVID to demand that we build the kind of workforce and programs and assistance that our families desperately need in this country. And frankly, we should not be having to stand vigil for 60 hours for the bare minimum, which is what we had. We should be adding $1 trillion in investments in healthcare in this country and in caregiving services in this country, as opposed to cutting it. And so, no, this is not a done deal, because I have seen time and time again the way that everyday people and our everyday acts of courage and our decisions to tell our stories, to take action, to stand vigil for however long it takes, to march, to stand up, that those acts of courage are what eventually makes history in this country. And there's already an effort to cancel the cuts, to repeal these cuts. And there has been a longstanding effort that is building to put into place the kind of care system we actually need and deserve, building on Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security. We need to strengthen these systems and programs for the 22nd century, not gut them.
Ai-Jen Poo, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and executive director of Caring Across Generations and co-founder of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, nationally recognized expert on elder and family care, as well as the future of work and immigration. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Among the millions who will be impacted by Medicaid cuts are people with disabilities and their families and communities. In addition to today being the 60th anniversary of Medicaid, last week was the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. This is President George H.W. Bush speaking July 26, 1990.
This act is powerful in its simplicity. It will ensure that people with disabilities are given the basic guarantees for which they have worked so long and so hard. Independence, freedom of choice, control of their lives, the opportunity to blend fully and equally into the rich mosaic of the American mainstream. And legally, it will provide our disabled community with a powerful expansion of protections and then basic civil rights. I now lift my pen to sign this Americans with Disability Act and say, let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down. God bless you all.
Let the shameful wall of exclusion come tumbling down, said President George H.W. Bush. Following its passage, Justin Dart, known as one of the fathers of the ADA, called it, quote, the world's first declaration of equality for people with disabilities by any nation, unquote. Justin Dart founded the American Association of People with Disabilities, or AAPD. We're joined now in Washington by Maria Town, the current president and CEO of AAPD, longtime disability rights activist. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maria. Thanks so much for joining us. Talk about the significance of this moment with the massive cuts to Medicaid now being played out. What is the Yale study? They said something like they expect 51,000 people a year to die as a result of the cuts to health insurance overall.
Yes. You know, as this reconciliation fight was happening, disabled people, working class people kept saying that people will die as a result of these cuts. But for us, that wasn't based on a statistical model. That was based on lived experience of having to watch our friends and family members and loved ones die because we could not get the care that we needed to survive, much less thrive. Prior to Medicaid and really prior to the Americans with Disabilities Act, disabled people were often either forced to live in institutions or forced to stay home behind closed doors because there was no system for us to get our needs met in the community. And Medicaid, combined with the Americans with Disabilities Act, really created the foundation for which disabled people could achieve community integration. With these cuts, once they take effect, disabled people, older adults, disabled children will die. You know, I was born with a developmental disability. I received Medicaid as a child, and I know so many people like me, disabled adults living and thriving now, who were able to get to adulthood because Medicaid existed. I am imagining in this moment so many kids who will not get a chance to make it to adulthood because of these cuts, and I'm imagining so many adults whose lives will be cut short and they will not be able to live into old age because of these cuts. Those numbers are very, very real to disabled people right now.
As a kid with cerebral palsy, you grew up in Louisiana. Can you talk about what happened when Louisiana cut Medicaid, what that meant for your family?
I lost my Medicaid. So I was on a Medicaid waiver, like many kids with disabilities. And through that waiver, I received things like physical therapy in my home. I received support from direct support workers within the care workforce. And my mom received respite. And this allowed her to go back to school to become a nurse and to raise my brothers and I. All three of us have disabilities, really, as a single mom. And when Louisiana decided to basically balance its budget on the backs of poor and disabled people, I had to go through what was called a redetermination. The state had to decide if I was still disabled, even though cerebral palsy is lifelong and never goes away. And they decided that I was too smart to need these services, even though, you know, to this day, I still struggle with mobility. I still need support. I still need support every day. I had assistance getting dressed before I could come to this interview. And we lost all of it. And we fought it. We fought it. We went to a judge and we lost. And today it is harder for little girls with disabilities to get Medicaid supports than it was for me more than 30 years ago. And that should not be the case. As Ijen said, rather than cutting from Medicaid. We should be investing in Medicaid and other systems that support our kids, our families, and our older adults to really live with dignity and thrive in their communities.
I want to go to a testimonial video made during the Medicaid vigil of Brian Coppola, who is legally blind and hard of hearing.
My name is Brian Coppola. I am legally blind and hard of hearing. I rely on Medicaid or MassHealth, as it is Massachusetts' version of it, because I can get transportation to and from doctors and facilities of medical nature due to the fact that I'm legally blind. I also depend on MassHealth to cover essential disability-related expenses, such as hearing aids and any other medical things I may need due to my disabilities, including sometimes eye exams. It would be a disaster to take my Medicaid away from me and put some working requirements in when I need the insurance the most. I cannot afford to be cut off from Medicaid. This is wrong, wrong, wrong.
And this is another testimony recorded for the Medicaid vigil.
Hi, my name is Corey Gilmore. I have a adults with physical developmental disabilities waiver. I currently live in Anchorage, Alaska. Without the support of the staff, I couldn't even get out of bed every day. And everybody who experiences a disability has something to contribute to society. And it is time that people realize we're more than just a problem for society to deal with. We want to contribute. We want to give back to our communities. We volunteer. We speak up when things are wrong, but we also bring solutions to problems. And these Medicaid cuts, you know, they say, oh, they won't affect people with disabilities, but you can't get to the kind of savings that people are talking about without affecting people with disabilities. It just doesn't work. So please, this is our livelihood. This is our life. And our disabilities are not things to be corrected. We came with them.
Maria Towne is president of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Your final comments about what needs to happen right now and why you don't see this is the end of the line that just these cuts have to be accepted.
Disabled people have always fought for our right to exist. We have had to defend and try to save Medicaid and the American healthcare system multiple times. I know that disabled people are going to keep fighting to cancel these cuts, to repeal this bill, and forcing our nation to respect our lives and provide us with a system where we can thrive.
Maria Towne, President and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities, on this month of the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Next up, we go to Arwa Damon, founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Stay with us. For food aid for people in Gaza, singing while occupying the offices of the Senate Majority Leader, Senator John Thune, as they protest the Israeli government's blockade of Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip are reporting 7 new deaths due to famine and malnutrition as Israel continues its starvation campaign against the Palestinian territory. Gaza's hunger-related death toll is now at 154, with at least 89 children among the dead. We're joined now by Arwa Damon, award-winning journalist, formerly with CNN, now founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Her new piece for the Atlantic Council is headlined, Inside the Israeli Government's Starvation of Gaza, from an aid group trying to deliver food. She previously spent 18 years at CNN, including as senior international correspondent, joining us from Erla, Turkey. Thanks so much for joining us again, Arwa. Describe what is happening right now in Gaza.
You know, it continues to be indescribable, to be frank. We do have these airdrops that are taking place. We do have what is being described as a trickle of trucks going in, but nothing is happening to actually genuinely stave off the starvation that we're seeing across the Gaza Strip. These airdrops, what we saw of them, for example, in the first 48 hours since Israel allowed them to begin, barely amount to a couple of trucks. What is managing to get into Gaza that is being collected by humanitarian organizations quite often does not make it to the warehouse, because organizations are either having to confront armed gangs, and I'll note here that these armed gangs operate in what's known as the red zone, which means that these are areas that are fully under Israeli control, and yet somehow these armed gangs continue to have the capacity to operate there, or the trucks are quite simply swarmed by masses of starving and desperate Gazans. The situation is beyond atrocious. Look, my organization, Inara, managed to recently get its hands on some fresh vegetables. And this isn't produce that came in from the outside. This is locally grown produce in the few greenhouses that are still accessible. And each parcel that we distributed was roughly 13 pounds. So 13 pounds of fresh vegetable cost $120. And I was watching the video sent over by the team, and you would have thought that the children who were grabbing at these vegetables were grabbing at their favorite candy bar. And the joy that was felt by this one family is just so disproportionate. You would have thought that someone had given them the best gift ever. And that just really goes to underscore the level of hunger, of desperation, of struggle that is happening there. And it is quite simply illogical and absurd that the best solution that the world can come up with right now is airdrops and a few dozen trucks, when we're talking about needing hundreds of trucks every single day to begin to reverse the impact that this prolonged hunger and starvation crisis has had on the vast majority of Gaza's 2.1 million residents.
I wanted to get your response to the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. in an interview on CNN with Wolf Blitzer yesterday. His name is Yehiel Leiter. He claimed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is flooding food into Gaza.
We feel the same way. The Prime Minister feels the same way, and that's why he's taken every decision possible to have food flood into Gaza. As a matter of fact, right now as we speak, there's 636 trucks, semi-trailers, waiting to enter Gaza, and the UN agencies are not picking them up because of their argument with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. I appeal to the international community, to the media. I mean, look, there have been pictures that have been broadcast, even on CNN, I gotta say this, excuse me, but even on CNN, pictures of children who are suffering from cerebral palsy or cystic fibrosis, not from hunger, and yet we're condemned for it. This has a long history of pointing the finger at the Jewish state and really has to stop.
So that's the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Yehiel Leiter. Arwa Damon, can you respond?
Yeah, and I'll respond on a couple of points that he made. First of all, on the issue of, you know, U.N. agencies refusing to pick up the trucks. This is not the case. And let me just explain what the process is to actually pick up your cargo once it has been cleared by Israel. And I'll quote a colleague of mine who quite simply put it as, it's not as if you're going to a McDonald's drive-thru. When we want to go and pick up humanitarian aid that has been cleared by Israel, we first have to put in what's known as a movement request. So Israel has to approve our movement, because to go and pick up that aid, we have to go through the red zone. This is not a quick process. Add to that, on the day that you want to actually move, you have to again wait for Israel to give you the green light. You then move to a holding point where you again wait for the green light, and then you're able to move and get whatever it is that you're able to load up onto these trucks. Now, recently over the weekend, for example, there were 15 movement requests that were put through. Half of them were flat out denied. Others were impeded, and only a handful of those 15 movement requests were actually able to go forward. So humanitarian organizations want to go and pick up the aid. We need Israel to facilitate that process and to ensure that that aid is able to be safely picked up. On the issue of the images of, you know, starving children and this claim that they all have underlying chronic or congenital conditions. On the one hand, look, when we're talking about something like hunger and starvation, we're talking right now at this stage about weeks and weeks and weeks where the population of Gaza has gone through very low intake of nutrients and a very low intake of calories. This will first and foremost impact children under the age of 5 whose bodies are still growing, who need those energy stores to be able to keep going. And this results in what is known among children as wasting. So their bodies are quite literally eating themselves up because they don't have enough energy store. And when it comes to children who have underlying chronic and or congenital conditions, yes, they are among the first to also be highly susceptible to dying from malnutrition and starvation because their bodies are already weakened. And so to say, oh, look, this child has cerebral palsy and that's why they died, that is very misleading. Not to mention that a child with cerebral palsy, if they do have access to proper nutrients, proper food, proper medical care, they can actually live to be anywhere between 30 to 70 years old. But I will also point out that it's not the first time that we're hearing Israeli officials deny what we're seeing with our very own eyes. We have also heard this from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself saying there's no starvation in Gaza. We can see what's happening. We talk to our colleagues every single day. My own staff message me saying, quite simply, Arwa, I'm hungry. And so we're at a point right now where, you know, it really feels as if Israel wants us or is trying to convince us that what we're seeing, what we're hearing from the population of Gaza, what we're hearing from Palestinian journalists, what we're hearing from humanitarians and other medical staff on the ground, be they Palestinians or those who are going in on any number of missions, that they're all somehow not seeing what they're actually seeing, and we're not somehow seeing what is playing out on our screens every single day. It's ridiculous.
And you know, you as a former CNN journalist, they can let the journalists in. There are Palestinian journalists, many have been killed, but they do not allow in international journalists.
No, they don't. And actually there was, I think it was yesterday or the day before, BBC and Sky News were taken on an airdrop that was carried out by Jordan, as the BBC was reporting, they were very specifically told not to film out the window. And this call for international journalists to be allowed access to Gaza has been ongoing since the beginning of all of this. And that's not to take away anything from the extraordinary work that Palestinian journalists themselves have been doing. But the sad reality is that if the international media, the outside media, wants to be able to push back against these frankly ludicrous Israeli claims, they do need to be allowed to go into Gaza and see it with their own eyes. And I have consistently said, and I said this from the first day I set foot in Gaza over a year ago, that if anyone goes into Gaza within 15 minutes, the vast majority of what Israel is claiming just unravels before your very eyes. And there is a reason why Israel doesn't want to allow journalists into Gaza. And it's not what Israel continuously claims, which are concerns over the journalists' safety, because they didn't even allow journalists, outside journalists, into Gaza during the ceasefire. And it does end up begging the question of, what are you so worried about? What are you afraid that these foreign journalists are going to actually uncover that you are continuing to deny them entry?
Oh, I wanted to turn to a video recorded by your team in Gaza.
Our team went to visit this family. The mother had showed up hysterical and desperate to our clinic. The twins were born in January. They're both running a fever. I mean, just look at the rashes. They have diarrhea, but there aren't enough Pampers. There's not enough water to wash. There's not enough anything. Look at what's left of the baby milk powder. It's barely a couple of scoops. But there isn't any available on the market or anywhere else because Israel has restricted the entry of baby milk powder. The kids are hungry. They haven't showered in ages. Mom shows us how she had to chop off one of her daughter's hair. It was so lice-filled that her scalp was bleeding. Our Inara team is able to provide them with whatever meager supplies that we still have. And one of the boys tells Yusta, our program coordinator, that it's his birthday the next day. And his mother says he asked her for bread on his birthday. Not a cake, just bread. And then do you know what happens? Yusta returns on her own time with this, a bread birthday cake. Because this is the sort of kindness and gentleness and generosity that defines Gaza and how its people look out for each other, whichever way they can.
It's Arwa Damon narrating the piece in Gaza. We last spoke to you, Arwa, just after you got out of Gaza last time in November. Are you allowed back in?
No, I'm not. I attempted to go back in, and I applied to go back in 5 times in February and March and was finally denied entry with no specific reason that was given. And it's worth noting, though, that the increase in denials of entry to those who are trying to go either on humanitarian missions or on medical missions has increased by 40%, and no one has really ever given a reason why. It's just feels really like another way to sort of continue to suffocate the efforts of humanitarian organizations on the ground. It's absolutely tragic. And I just want to point out, you know, in that clip, because listening to it, especially that ending part, really does make me smile. And I do wish that everyone could, you know, just think that as they're listening to the news, as they're listening to the numbers, so many of those people whose faces they're seeing, they carry the same level of kindness and tenderness that our staff, people like Yusra, do as well.
Arwa Damon, thanks so much for being with us. Founder of Inara, nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. We'll link to your piece for the Atlantic Council, Inside the Israeli Government's Starvation of Gaza, from an aid group trying to deliver food. Next up, we go to the occupied West Bank, where an Israeli settler fatally shot Oda Hadalin, a prominent Palestinian activist. He was 31 years old, who worked on the Oscar-winning film No Other Land. The Israeli settler is under international sanctions, but Trump lifted the U.S. sanctions on him. Stay with us. Kala by Sunny Singh in our Democracy Now! Studio. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. In the occupied West Bank, family and friends of the Palestinian activist and teacher, Oda Mohammed Hadalin, are reeling after an Israeli settler shot and killed him in a village near Hebron on Monday. Hadalin played a key role in the production of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land, which follows Palestinians in the community of Masafer Yatta as they struggle to stay on their land amidst violent attacks by Israeli settlers. Residents identified Hadalin's killer as Yinon Levy, an Israeli settler who was put on a European Union sanctions list last year for his violent attacks on Palestinians and property. The Biden administration sanctioned him, but the Trump administration earlier this year lifted the Biden-era sanctions on Levy. Video appears to show him brandishing and firing a handgun at Palestinians ahead of Monday's fatal attack. Oda's cousin and brother-in-law, Ala Hathalin, described what he saw happen.
Yesterday, as always, the occupations
continue to attack and ethnic cleansing the Palestinian force by all the ways. Yesterday, suddenly, the Israel bulldozers and the settlers were working here in the land of Umm al-Khayr. And then they're trying to move the bulldozer from the land to the settlement. And there's a Palestinian, private Palestinian land for us between them. And we tell them peacefully, don't do that. There's so many trees, there's a fence, you will destroy everything. Don't do any of that. Stop. We're trying peacefully to stop them. We call them many times, stop, stop, and they never hear to us. And they continue until he beat one of my brothers in his head with the bulldozers. And he was in coma. Then after that, he moved and continued. And as you see from here, he destroyed the fence and came here. And the bulldozers going inside. And the other settlers, Yunan Levy, the very, very well-known settlers, Yunan Levy arrived to the place here. There's no dangers for him. There's no one. We just was shouting, tell him, why are you doing that? We will call the police. This is not wrong. This is not right. This is what they think that you're doing. This is a private Palestinian land, according to even to Israel's court. This is a Palestinian land. And they never hear to us. They never listen to us. They continue to do whatever they want. When they arrive here, I was the one who's in front of him. I just filming him, trying to stop him. I tell him, please don't shoot. Don't shoot anyone. There's so many people. There's a children. Stop. And suddenly he's starting shooting a lot of pellets everywhere. And Oud was inside the center community, far from the event. He even didn't participate in anything. And they shoot Oud. Oud, the peaceful resistance man. Oud is the teachers. Oud is the father of the children. Oud is my cousins. Is my sister's husband. Three sons left without father. Because why? Because Yaron Levy, Trump decided to lift the sanction from him and give him the permission to continue to kill the Palestinian. This is what we see every day. This is what we're suffering every day. This is not from today. 4 years ago, they killed also my uncle, Sheikh Suleiman, by the same way, by the bulldozers run over him. When this will stop, we just want to live in peace, with our dignity, with our freedom, without suffering, with our rights.
That was Oda Hadaline's cousin and brother-in-law, Ala, speaking to Oren Zeev, who joins us now from Tel Aviv. Oren's a reporter and photographer with 972 Magazine and the independent Israeli news site Local Call. Just co-wrote a new piece about Oda with his colleagues, Basil Adra and Yuval Abraham, who are the directors of the Oscar-winning film No Other Land. Our deepest condolences, Oren. You knew Oda. Tell us the latest. This hasn't stopped. The Israeli military raided the funeral tent and arrested more of Oda's family after his death.
Thank you for having me. Yes, you are right. Unfortunately, this tragic incident that, of course, happened because of the backup the settlers on the ground get from the police, from the army, and from the Israeli government, this has continued. Although in this case, the victim is a Palestinian, the suspect shooter is a settler, a well-known one, as you mentioned, the Israeli authorities, the army, the police, and the settlers continued their campaign against the village. It's important to say that since the war in Gaza began, this community, like many others in the area, have been under constant pressure to leave, harassment, invasions, seizing of land, and other things. But you could imagine that at least while people are mourning the death of Oda, that was really loved among all the community and also by Israeli international activists that came to the village, they did not stop. The opposite. I was there yesterday. The army came very aggressively to the community center, to the place he was killed, the place people were gathering to remember him and order people to leave. They were pushing journalists, family members that are not from this specific village, and activists, people who knew him very well. They forced us out, and even in the entrance to the village, they started to throw stun grenades. And it's important to say, it's not only an attack on the family, on his friends. It's an attempt to prevent us from the journalists to investigate the case. Of course, we had to be there to see this place he was shot, to confirm that he was in the community center. He was not even near the bulldozer of the settlers. Later on, at night, the Israeli army raided the village, arresting 8 men, in addition to 5 Palestinians that were arrested during the incident, while the suspect, Yanon Levy, was released to house arrest by the Israeli court. Of course, the Palestinians are processed in the military system, so they would see a judge only in a few days. But I think this is not a coincidence. It's a message to the Palestinians, to the people who stand with them in Umm El Khair, that despite the tragedy, the settlers and the state are continuing the effort to push the people out. And, you know, even burying him, a very simple thing, the Israeli army is preventing him to be buried in his hometown, in his village. They want him to be buried in a nearby town, despite the fact his family obviously wants to bury him in the place he lived all his life, and he was active there. His friends and colleague told me, and I also knew him personally, that he was the most peaceful man. Every time I came there, I would see him. He'd always host and greet people and make tours there. He was in contact with the media. He was updating me weekly on the harassment, on the campaign of the settlers and the army to force them to leave. And it's a tragedy that it's hard to imagine. You know, Umm El Khair will not be the same without him.
Oren Zeev, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue to follow this and follow the funeral when it takes place. Again, family members have been taken of Alda, but the man who is responsible for his death has been released under house arrest. Oren Zeev, reporter and photographer for 972 Magazine, will link to your new piece about Alda, headlined "The Most Peaceful Person." I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post,